morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Democratic Perspective is back one more time. We are still celebrating the absence of Steve Williamson. No, of course we're not celebrating the absence. So we hope he's doing well wherever he is. I told him his trip reminds me of a Bukowski poem, Charles Bukowski. And we have somebody on this morning that can appreciate that statement. Because he has a book of poetry on his desk that he's had there for 40 years, according to one interview. We're talking to Jeff Biggers. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. Good to be back.
Do you really have a copy of Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman on your desk?
I do. You know, it's an old copy I found when I was this. I think I wasn't even a student then, but. It's never left, and I take a peek at it almost every day.
Wow. I do have a great deal of respect, and also have an old copy of Leaves of Grass, which I'm going to put on the corner of my desk, where, of course, it will disappear under a ton of crap. But we're here to talk about resistance. And Jeff wrote a book. He wrote lots of books. He wrote 8 books, which, once again, as a sometimes writer, I admire anybody with that sort of discipline. He is a chronicler, and you can stop me here, but if I'm wrong, or you can correct me after her. You chronicle kind of the American social justice, if for want of a better term, a term that I think doesn't appear anywhere except in, and I'm going to say, liberal media, or it used to be religion. I taught a class for the Catholic Church, and social justice was the name of the class. And I admired the nun that gave me that assignment. You don't see a lot of that anymore, but that's what Jeff Biggers does, I think, and that's kind of his niche in the literary world is certainly the social justice niche. And so I want to say this: I did invite Jeff here to talk. I promise he's really here. That just the fact that his book, Resistance. He has a book named Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition, exists. I think, you know, Jeff, in a lot of the reviews I saw or the things I've seen, just the fact that the book exists pleased a lot of people. And I don't want to say on the left. I was going to say on the left, but all people, I mean, left and right in this country, and we've become so... everything is seen from a left-right perspective these days, but the fact that your book exists, that it's out there, that it says what it says about the connections of the resistance movement today and resistance movements throughout the American history is a good thing. But then today what I want to do is kind of get more into the book. You draw those lines from that time, from those times, to what's happening under the most oppressive regime in modern history. And maybe I haven't studied every presidential administration, but it's hard to imagine one that, we're just going to try to get specific here. One of the things I see when they're blasting Obama, one of my high school friends just sent me a note from Clint Eastwood, speaking of dropping names, railing about Obama. And it sounded like he was talking about Trump, and he knew what he was doing. At least the people that wrote it for him knew what he was doing. I think Clint, great man, you know, just go finish your pudding and take a nap, because not that I'm an ageist here, but I think you're being used as a pawn by the right. But the point is that we make those, we want to draw some lines from then till now. What you got? What have you been doing lately? Now, you got, speaking of drawing lines from then to now, I asked you about Greta Thunberg and the climate movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly. I think what we're saying in the book, and I think we said on the program last year when I was on a national tour, was, you know, a quintessential part of who we are as Americans goes back to the formation of our country to resist authority whenever there's an overreach and an attack on our democracy. That, you know, our nation came into being as a revolution. And even prior to that, we had centuries of rebellions that very much formed, you know, the character who we are and many aspects of who we are as a people in our nation. And well, I think we tend to forget that in 1619, of course, we've discussed that a lot recently, of course, that was the beginnings of slavery, at least in the part of the continent we call it now the United States of America. Of course, there was slavery already in the Caribbean and in some southern parts of what would become the United States. But in 1619, of course, 20 enslaved Africans were left in Jamestown, Virginia. And that in itself began a moment of resistance as well. You know, that if we're going to begin one of the first communities that would become the United States of America, you know, it was on the backs of certain people, the enslaved Africans, who were the foundations of our economy, you know, the beginnings of the economy there, and who then had to begin their own resistance movement. And, of course, there was all sorts of rebellions against working, about running away, about forming their own communities. And then within 2-3 years, the local indigenous people, the Lenape and the Potawatomi, you know, returned with their own attacks and their own resistance. And so, really, it was just at the very beginnings, the very first footprint on our country, of course, was full of rebellions.
So here you are, we're talking minorities in their resistance, I guess, because often the leadership, that the oppression was coming from whiteness, white leaders, and while black Americans don't necessarily seem as resistant or rebellion, I don't know, you drew a line to Black Lives Matter. And I think that was a good line to draw and an important one that I don't know, if somebody estimated it's 3 weeks, when there's an atrocity, Americans forget about it in 3 weeks. So when white police officers shoot unarmed black assailants for, small or no obvious reasons, it becomes it doesn't last, and so Black Lives Matter becomes a way to at least keep it on the front burner, and to slow this down. This was every week, every month there was a killing somewhere in the country, and then of course the right wing media would ramp up their, oh, but he had a history, whatever, he had a record. But I'm not sure the death sentence, in no case was the death sentence appropriate. Mm. And so that line has been drawn. But the idea that resistance is not disrespect, Jeff. It says, you know, the other side talks about America haters. And that you and I would be America haters because we're criticizing America. You and I would be Trump haters because we're criticizing Trump. And so there's no, I have no room for, they'll end an argument or end a discussion because they have no room for hate. Help me out with this.
Yeah. I mean, if you really go back to the origins of our country, I think one thing we have learned is the greatest American trait, the greatest American value is dissent. And it's not a negative anti-American thing. It's in fact saying these people from the outside have abused their power. No different than King George when the British crown ran the English colonies. And that we have to resist against this kind of duplicitous authority that's attacking who we are and our inalienable right as human beings to function. To live in a society free, to live in a society where we have certain rights that shouldn't be taken away from us. And therefore, the greatest American act, the most patriotic thing we can ever do, is fight against this kind of overreach of authority, this kind of oppression, this kind of recklessness. And I think that is the very essence of what the American Revolution was about and what has pushed us forward for the past 250 years. I think what's very important is you began by saying I'm a chronicler of social justice, and I largely see myself as a storyteller, and of course by profession I'm a journalist, and I think really and truly I'm a cultural historian, and I go to regions to look at their history, and it's not that I'm seeking out social justice, but wherever there is conflict, wherever there is tension, there emerges these kind of amazing movements of a very few people. It's always a small group of people who are willing to risk their necks and be courageous and to hold societies and the majority accountable for the very things that we live in and believe in, which is inalienable rights, our rights to democracy, our human rights, our civil rights, and the rights of nature. And this, once again, goes back to who we are with the American Revolution. You know, going back to 1619, of course, in Jamestown, one thing we don't talk about was not only there was the rebellion of Africans and the rebellion of Native Americans, but the first work stoppage and labor strike happened in 1619 because the English had brought over Polish glassmakers to work in the original colonies, and they were not given the right to vote. And so within the first few days of being in the very first colony that survived, you actually had a labor strike of people saying, hey, if we're going to live in this new world, this new colony, we all must have the same rights. And that essentially has been the same story we've seen for the past, 400 years.
Exactly. And I remember that section of the book, and the right to vote through resistance was extended to the Poles, not to the rest of the residents of Virginia, but at least it was progress. And I think that's, your work is often linked to progressive movements, I think. And yet, one of the best things that it does, it ties it to normalcy. This is normalcy when there's overreach. And boy, has there been overreach. It disturbs me and it pains me that the Trump supporters don't see it. Don't see the destruction of the document. They don't of the Constitution. The constitutional violations. When a president doesn't respond to a congressional subpoena, which is the force of law, when the president doesn't respond and instructs people, we can talk obstruction of justice on another show. Then that calls for resistance. That calls for something. Actually, it calls for the person to be incarcerated, quite frankly, the president. The president should be in jail for the crimes that he's committed in the Oval Office. So these are the kinds of things, I think, that that make resistance patriotic.
All right. So let's bring it up now to Greta Thunberg, which you ask about. Here's this 16-year-old Swedish student. And a year ago, she was distraught, realizing had been very little action on climate change or whatever we want to refer to it. And once again, the debate over whether there's climate change or not is over. We don't need to expend another second about that.
Yes.
When you look at the facts that in July we had the hottest month on record, where I'm living now in the Midwest, we had record floodings in Iowa ourselves this spring. We are bookended by historic floods in western Iowa and then historic floods in eastern Iowa, where our farmers couldn't even get their crops in time, and they're losing billions of dollars this year for various reasons, and they don't even know if they'll be able to have a harvest this year because of an early frost. When you look at massive and historic fires going on from Angola to the Amazon to Indonesia to Turkey all the way up to Alaska and Siberia, when you see that there's heat waves in this very week happening in Australia to Vietnam to India to historic double cyclones in Mozambique in the spring, where the discussion is over.
Yeah.
You know, I work with some of the most conservative farmers in the Midwest. And the issue now is, it's not how much is it going to cost to do something. The question is, how much is it going to cost if we don't do something?
There you go.
You know, each one of these floods that we face, or each one of these catastrophic fires that you face in the far west, often result in millions, if not billions, of dollars.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of cleanup we have to do. And so I think now we're looking at this opportunity that we've reached this hinge moment in history, just like we did with the American Revolution, just like we've done with abolishing slavery, just like we've done with finally recognizing immigrant rights, just like we did with women's rights, and so many parts of our history where we finally have had this awakening, and we realize we need to move on and kind of embrace who we are with our democracy. We've really reached this moment now that we must do something and quickly to really not only mitigate and adapt to the massive climate destabilization and extreme weather, but to also rebuild our countries.
Right.
You know, this is the scary thing. You know, here we are in beautiful Sedona.
Yeah.
That tomorrow could be obliterated like Paradise, California, with a wildfire. And, you know, here I drove up yesterday from Phoenix, and you just feel the brittleness. Yeah. Of a region that, you know, just simply has not had enough water. Just like, you know, not too long ago, I was in North Carolina mountains who've gone, you know, weeks, if not months without rain. And they're, you know, really terrified themselves with another fire coming through. And I think what happened in Paradise, California last year, you know, a beautiful town just like Sedona,
yeah,
that within hours, the entire town was gone.
Wow.
From a raging fire. And that in itself should be enough to tell us that, hey, whether you're left, whether you're right, whether you're Republican, whether you're Democrat, we all have to come together right now and do something not only constructive, but something radical to reinvent and re-envision who we are and start creating a green economy and a green plan.
Well, that's true. The science is there. So, and for a lot of us, the science has always been there. But now, not only do we have the science, you know, 98% of scientists have been telling us this for years. We have the reality. We have the observable, the empirical reality. We can see it happening. So, where and the resistance comes in when people like this young woman and the climate strike. They're calling you guys. I'm going to say you guys, but they're calling it a climate strike. Is that right?
Yeah. So who is Greta, if our listeners don't know? She's this 16-year-old Swedish teen who a year ago really felt like nothing was happening enough. Her mother was a famous opera singer. They had gone to electric cars. They shop locally. You know, they have solar panels. They basically said, hey, we're doing our part. But, you know, that's nothing. You know, and I think the issue is 70% of the world's population lives in cities. And that's where the majority of our carbon footprint is coming from.
Right.
But the other horrific detail is that 70% of these major urban centers are on coastal areas that are really going to be affected by rising tides.
Right.
So Greta decided the only thing she could do was to go in front of the Swedish parliament, and she had a little sign that says, I'm not going to go to school anymore. What's the point? I'm not going to have a habitable future because, you know, the writing is on the wall. We've read the science, and we know quickly that if we don't stabilize our carbon emissions and reduce our carbon emissions and reach zero emissions, you know, there is no future.
Right.
So it was almost a nihilistic act,
right,
to say, why on earth should I even go to school? There's
right.
no hope. And she basically said, I'm not asking for your hope. I'm not asking for you to come here and console me. You know, I want you to show me you can do something. So at first,
she was speaking to a government body. And
right.
said, you guys can do something about this.
Right. So at first, everybody ignored her, and she simply didn't go away. And I think one thing Greta Thunberg has taught us is that the one-day protests really are not effective. It's that idea that you're going to protest or go on strike, and you're simply not going to go away and create this kind of tension and confrontation until we come to some sort of resolution. And I think this is what we learned with the revolution here in the United States. It's what we learned with the civil rights movement and so much of our women's movements and environmental strikes and, you know, today in Detroit with the United Auto Workers.
Got to be in it for the long haul.
Long haul. So she came back week after week, and finally people started paying attention. And then eventually the idea of a student strike took off across Europe into Germany, into England, into France. And you had thousands of students refusing to go to school on Fridays. They called it Fridays for the Future. And eventually it spread to the United States that in March 15th of the spring, you had millions of students refusing to go to school. And what's beautiful, it included my own kids.
Really?
I had a 14-year-old middle school son who simply said, you know, in our town, we're a bunch of liberals, but we don't have a climate plan that really matters. It's kind of a climate plan on paper. And he said, here I am in middle school, and I've never had a single course dealing with the issue of climate change. You know, I've gone through all my schooling, and the teachers, you know, literally have not brought it up in any course.
Wow.
And so he, with his little cadre of friends, began to do this strike. And they went on strike for 12 weeks in our town of Iowa. And they were very confrontational. We have this kind of idea of being Iowa nice.
Yes, exactly. I'm shocked, right. More so than I normally would be.
To not confront people. And the kids showed up at the school board hearings. They showed up at city council hearings. And they just frankly shamed the adults in the room. They began with questions saying, like, today we should ask all of our listeners, where does your electricity come from? Now, where's your power plant, and what is burning in that power plant?
Yeah.
And the school board and the city council people couldn't answer.
Probably.
And they said, you know, last year carbon emissions increased by 3% in Iowa, largely due to factory farms. How are you dealing with that? You know, in Iowa, we're very proud of the fact we have this amazing wind industry. We get 40% of our electricity from wind. But the other part is we have this massive industrialized agriculture that has a huge carbon footprint. And the kids just went step by step. Wouldn't go away, and eventually, just to make a long story short, they forced the school board and the city council to fall in line with the United Nations. It's called the IPCC, the International Governmental Agency on Climate Change, to fall in line with their criteria, which is that our city now has declared they're going to cut their carbon emissions by 45% by 2030 and reach zero emissions by 2050. And the school district agreed as well.
Wow.
And so they're talking about putting solar panels on, shifting to electric buses, you know, having local food, having compost and recycling, and planting trees. And this was all because of Greta Thunberg, a young student who showed the rest of the world that they need to reclaim this incredible tradition of resistance in whatever country.
I want to get a local plug in here. I know the Northern Arizona Climate Change Alliance has been, and I may have messed up one word in there, but it's pretty close to that, are trying to get local students. They're trying it at Mingus Union High School. They're trying it at Sedona Red Rock High School. They've talked to people. At least I'm led to believe that they were trying to this nationwide thing on Sedona 20th, on September 20th.
Right.
On September 20th, that to make the statement, and I really like the idea. I didn't know about Fridays for the Future. In other words, there is a compromise here. This isn't some act of rebellion where kids are just getting adult permission to be naughty. We're recognizing that if something that there may be a future, that there are some things, that there is a there is a middle road here. That as on a climate strike, it's not all or nothing is all I'm getting at. Where very often adults would get up in arms because, you know, we're instructing the kids to be not behave and not obey their elders or that kind of thing.
Well, but I think the kids also are asking a big question here. It's why is it taking children to refuse to go to school to get adults to do the right thing? You know, and I think that's what they're asking, is that, hey, when you see what is happening unfolding before our own eyes, when you read the research, when you realize there's this incredible opportunity to reinvest in our economies, you know, we had an incredible young student, and I'll never forget, in front of our city council and then in front of our school board, who said, hey, the fastest growing job right now in the heartland is working on wind turbines and as a technician, or working on solar panels.
Wow.
You know, you can get paid $65,000 to $75,000 a year, which is a great job. It's as much as you'd pay anyone to go work underground in a coal mine.
Right.
And they're saying, how come our schools are not training us to do this kind of technology? You know, here's an opportunity for us to be part of a new green world, a new green deal, a new green economy. And I think the kids were actually very convincing to say, hey, it's not a matter of just protesting. It's a matter of equipping us to realize we're going to have an incredibly different future than the one that we've been living in.
Very important distinction. I mean, it's a practical side to all this. once again, jumping back a little bit, we may have talked about this on the lab, but you wrote the book in response to a question from your son. And I'm going to, his real question, was there any hope for the future? And that your book was the response to your son's question. Where your mind went to going into resistance and going into how societies correct themselves, over the years, over the centuries for that matter, when you get duplicitous administrations like we have now that are enriching themselves beyond, our imagination at our expense.
Right. No, my son said, is there hope? And this was after President Trump refused to be part of the rest of the world with the climate accord in Paris, which already now is anachronistic. It falls short. You know, even then it was not enough. And right. So now here we are, you know, 2 years later, we need to be even much more proactive. And so my thing was not to look at my young son and say, be glib about it and say, oh, sure, there's plenty of hope. Things will work out. You know, there is no hope.
Right.
But that's not the issue. The issue is that hope resists. And that's something I learned and I was taught by my elders, both my parents, but also by a theologian I worked with. His name was William Sloan Coffin. Mm-hmm. And in the 1980s, we realized we needed to do something about South Africa and apartheid. You know, here we had this incredibly racist institution, South Africa, which had segregated whites and blacks and a majority black country, obviously. And the United States, of course, then had a president named Reagan who referred to the majority black movement as a bunch of communists. And they refused to put sanctions like the rest of the world. We were completely isolated in this, in that we were defending apartheid. And so there is a national and a global movement, much like today with the global movement on climate change. The idea is that how do we deal with countries that are out of control and reckless, who are denying rights to their own citizen? And, of course, Nelson Mandela was in prison at that point. And so there was a movement across the United States to not only divest our funds from South African countries and the country of South Africa companies, but to actually go straight to their embassies and do sit-ins. And we did that for 445 days. And one day while we were in jail in Washington, and became something that actors and writers and religious leaders and teachers and students from across the country had converged on Washington for over a year, it was there in the Washington jail, and Coffin said something that he had heard from the civil rights movement in the 1960s. He was one of the first freedom writers in 1961 in Alabama. He'd been taken off the bus and manhandled and beaten up and thrown into jail, and he really wanted to fight back. And the young civil rights activists, the African Americans, said, hey, you know, you need to calm down a bit and realize that we're in it for the long haul here.
Right.
And he basically said, hey, there's no hope. We're not going to be able to stop this kind of racism in the South. And it was the young African Americans in Alabama who turned to Coffin and said, It's not a matter about having hope. It's hope resists.
Hope resists.
And hopelessness adapts.
Which is the name of Jeff Bigger's introduction in his book. It's a book in five parts. I like it because it is kind of compact. But Hope Resists is the name of the introduction of resistance, reclaiming American tradition. I, of course, like on the last show, and I went on and on about the Thomas Paine part. Since then, I've become enamored with more parts. Because it is almost like a reference book where there's section or each story. And I want to talk a little bit. I'm going to depart here because heck, it's my show. About your style, I really like that when you know the kinds of things that you do. And it's not I don't know if it's Jeff Bigger's, but I've seen similar anyway to where we just get to the story. You know, I don't want to say that there's not an introduction, that there's not a setup, or what do they call it in drama? There's not the exploration or the beginning, but so much of it is we just go straight to the story. You'll just start demonstrating the next point where you're moving from point to point, or moving from story to story, or moving from example to example of resistance and how this population or that population resisted and the results thereof, and how throughout history, throughout American history this happened, where I think, you know, a more texty book would spend a lot more time setting it up and maybe with introductions when it's so refreshing just to get to the story. I'm going to compare it to there's many other, I want to say young writers, but living writers that I admire, Chuck Palahniuk and many others that have similar ideas that in order to tell the story, we can get to the meat of it. You know, we've been around for a while. We don't always need a 2 or 3 or 5 paragraph a setup. Anyway, I was going to give some examples, but I forgot. We're on radio here. We don't have that much time. I do want to I want to switch to this that in dealing with, and I'm quoting Jeff Biggers here, in dealing with the most challenging issues of every generation, resistance to duplicitous civil authority and its corporate enablers has defined our quintessential American story. We started the show today about talking about the quintessential American story. I mean, I like that because it's a sort of a compact. The corporate enablers and the duplicitous politicians, when Trump says one thing and what he's doing is enriching himself and his friends and his family, that's duplicity, folks. And when the corporations say nothing, and when the Republican Party says nothing, no matter how outrageous the behavior becomes, one of the resistance sources over the years has been simply a place at the table for whoever is out at the moment. Trump came into office as a Muslim hater and denying them a place at the table. Trump came into office saying that there was only room at the table for white people. People, writers like yourself and others have said, hey, wait a minute. You know, there's always been people that will try to do this, but this is how we get our place at the table. And so that's, I'm just still looking for, I want to talk about, when Pence went to Hamilton and the young man directed his comments from the stage about that the administration seems to target, for whatever reason, is it pure racism? Is there an economic reason? I got the cultural historian on the show here. Tell me what's going on. Why are they doing this?
So to get some little context, so the big Broadway show Hamilton,
yes,
it kind
please.
Of swept the nation a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And it really looked at Alexander Hamilton, you know, as this man who'd come up from the Caribbean and, of course, went on to become the Minister of Finance, kind of the vice president, and then, of course, had his famous duel with Aaron Burr. And so the Broadway show, which was amazing, was largely done with actors of color, African-Americans and Puerto Ricans and Dominicans. And it was an amazing show. And so Vice President Pence went there just a few months after the election. I guess this would have been like in the winter of 2017.
Right.
Like in February, whatnot. And he, you know, there were some boos in the crowd, you know, who didn't want him there. And of course, the actors came out and actually quieted down the boos and said, no, we welcome everybody in our theater. And then afterwards, the main actor who played the role of Aaron Burr came out on the stage and read a beautiful statement saying, you know, we all have to be included in this new administration. And it was a very beautiful kind of welcome to the vice president. And, of course, Trump immediately goes on to Twitter and says, wow, they're being disrespectful to the vice president. You should shut down the show.
Yeah, and was asked for an apology.
Yeah, an apology.
As he is insulting every race and ethnicity there ever was.
Right. And, of course, it was immediately an attack on young African-American actors, completely out of context, without any sense of truly what happened, completely an incredible distortion like we've seen so much on Twitter with Trump. And I think you're asking a very good question. How on earth can we have a president refer to four sitting members of Congress and tell them they need to go back to where they've come from, including an African-American congresswoman from Connecticut, or Massachusetts, excuse me, or a member of Congress from New York City, or a member of Congress, you know, from Minnesota.
Right.
And I think that's the kind of question we have to ask ourselves is, why is it that a president spends so much time, not only in front of the TV, but on Twitter, you know, verbally attacking people of color, and especially women, in this kind of context? And yeah, obviously it's racism. It's a sense of white supremacy. It's a sense of wanting to completely dehumanize the people of another color, especially women.
Okay, that this poor, sick, deluded old man, who obviously has something wrong with him, but he has the enablers, Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the enablers. Tell me something that good about the enablers, or bad about the enablers.
Enablers sounds like a good name for like a country band or something.
Yeah.
You know, the enablers. You know, I think we often don't realize that, you know, I once again, I'm just obsessed with history. Go back to Jamestown. Jamestown was a corporation. You know, it wasn't the British king who founded that community. It was the Jamestown Company. And that our nation was born as part of the experiment of capitalism, which had been going on, of course, since the Renaissance in Italy and Europe. And, of course, throughout history, our government has been tied part and parcel with corporations. So when President Trump... still struggle to say that, but when Trump, you know, rolls back, you know, 89 major environmental regulations, including last week rolling back some of the basic protections we've had under the Clean Water Act that now will allow mining companies to dump straight into our waterways and streams and ultimately affect the water downstream for everyone. He's doing that on behalf of corporations who will, you know, exploit and capitalize from this.
Right.
And this is the kind of corporate enablers who've worked hand in hand with so much of the corruption and so much of the anti-democracy that we've had to deal with over centuries. And so that's why I talked about it. It's not just an issue of resistance against some reckless power, but that power is propped up and enabled by certain corporations. And that's the kind of structure I think we have to grapple with. I mean, I'm very much enamored with people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are very forthright that we're looking at an issue of corruption here. You know, I covered the coal industry for nearly 20 years, and the coal industry, you know, rarely followed the law, that virtually every mining accident was not an accident at all, but it was a mine that had completely gone outside and circumvented the regulations and the laws, and it was an accident waiting to happen. And that ultimately these corporations were no different than a mafia in terms of how they had worked with the government.
Exactly.
And I feel like that's what we're talking about in resisting not only against reckless powers, but the reckless corporations who benefit from it.
I got Jeff Biggers here, author of Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. He's I'm going to call him a local boy, but he has local ties here. So when he's in town.
I have a very important local tie.
He comes by.
Yeah. That I'm actually here in Sedona for one reason.
Yes.
And that is because my wonderful father has his 89th birthday today.
Oh,
can you
my.
Imagine? And so here I am.
What's
to
your
say,
father's name?
My dad is John Biggers. He's this amazing man. If you're someone who rents a house or apartment in Arizona, you will daily thank him because he single-handedly pushed through the Landlord-Tenant Act, which gave the rights to renters to be treated fairly. Really an incredible act of tradition, resistance. A man who, and my mother who came here from the Midwest in southern Illinois. We were based in Tucson in 1970 when there was the massive urban renewal, which really was about urban removal of Latinos and the barrios. Someone who had worked for decades to bring Arizona into the 20th and 21st century. And here it's so wonderful to be back in Sedona to share with him his 89th birthday. Think about it, nearly nine decades of
John Biggers, the Landlord-Tenant Act is studied by every realtor who hopes to get a license in Arizona. And it's a good thing because it is pretty, it protects
by the way, it protects landlords too. It doesn't just protect tenants. So for those people that are on that side of the fence. But I'm going to, since we're, anyway, happy birthday, John Biggers. And I'm glad your son came home to say hello. The, I want to ask about the, If for those of you that want to actually see Jeff Biggers, he will be in Cottonwood tomorrow at the Red Rooster Cafe. He'll be there by 6 o'clock. Kat and the crew and Claudia will be there to welcome you. And there's a little soup, there's a little wine, there's a little bread. It's, I don't want to say it's a typical, liberal event, but come on over and, listen to, Jeff has a great, way of presenting his information. And we want to make sure that if you live in Sedona, if you live in Rimrock, you want to talk a little bit about, the book, you want to talk a little bit about resistance, you want to talk a little bit about climate science, you want to hear some things, come on by Rooster 6 o'clock tomorrow, in Cottonwood, Old Town Cottonwood. Jeff, I'm going to completely switch gears here and use you a little bit for, an idea. Matter of fact, I got this from a local Sedonan, and it's not a new idea, but Gail Kennedy sent me an email. She said, why don't they just support, and Dan Rather, I believe, to give this a little star status here, agreed with the idea. So it's, it starts there. Democratic candidates get behind one candidate. Which one of them? Trump is going to run the nastiest campaign probably in American history. There's going to be lies at every turn. There's going to be voter suppression at every turn. He's going to say the meanest, most horrible thing. We already know that. Who can stand up to that? Dan Rather believes Elizabeth Warren is the choice. And that the sooner the better, at least from Gail's, my local standpoint, the sooner that happens, the better, that they get behind one candidate and then they start talking about cabinet positions. That's the, you know, no, everybody knows now that's what goes on behind the scenes. So it's 2019. It's not like it's a big secret anymore. Maybe it was in, you know, 1994, but it's not now, that they're jockeying for the top job, for the president's position. But who's, how about, is this an idea? Is this an idea that's workable?
Oh, I think so. And I think the last
in two
debate,
minutes.
Right. I think the last debate really showed that, we have, you know, dozens of extraordinary candidates.
Yep.
And they're all very equipped and very prepared and they all have their own ideas. And I think everybody's going down the same road in terms of what we need to do with the future, in terms of creating a green economy. And so we have a lot of great ideas out there, especially with healthcare as well. I think we're definitely, it's been a watershed shift on healthcare. But, you know, Elizabeth Warren stands out head and shoulders above all the candidates as the leader. And I think the debate, as Biden stumbled all over the place, as Bernie, I think, struggled to really find his voice, literally, and as a lot of younger candidates weren't quite, you know, as forthcoming, I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren really is the candidate who can roll up her sleeves and take on Trump in a way that is engaging, it's funny, it's endearing. But, you know, my God, I don't know anybody else in the country who is as informed and prepared as she is. You know, here's this brilliant woman who's truly ready to lead our country. I think that's who we have to rally behind.
Wonderful. Thank you, Jeff. That's a hopeful statement. We got hope resists and hope also just sometimes is just plain hope. We want to remind everybody that Jeff Biggers will be in Cottonwood tomorrow at the Red Rooster Cafe, 901 North Main, at 6 o'clock. Be sitting around with a bunch of folks, eating a little bit and talking about stuff. We want to remind everybody else that we want to thank the Democrats of the Red Rocks who, helped make this show possible. We want to thank all of us, everybody who maybe pushes that donate button on our website, VVID, Verde Valley Independent Democrats.org. You'll find this show archived there and a wonderful little synopsis written by one of our, crack staff here. On VVID.org, and we'll see you next time on Democratic Resistance. Thanks, folks.
You've been-
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.